his arms out like that, as a circle. But it was actually done by another artist named Vitruvius. So that's all I think we really need for this one. It's Shana and the Vitruvian Man. She's taking a lot of cortisone, and her hair is falling out, but she breathes a little better on the oxygen. Her cheeks are all puffed up, like Jerry Lewis, she says. But her ankles aren't as swollen, so at least she can get around. Every day when we talk on the phone, I say I have to visit soon. But when I get there, I don't know what to do. I clean the house and do a big shopping. We watch old movies at night. How Green Is My Valley and The Good Earth. Sometimes she falls asleep in the middle. She doesn't visit my father's grave. I can still feel him in the house, she says, and your Uncle Joey too, as she lights up the place with yardside candles. We come into this world alone and we leave the same way, in a matter-of-fact voice, she says. It's all fading away, memories, children, desires, fading away. I think of the movie The Incredible Shrinking Man. I remember him running across a bureau, fending off a spider with a pin. He's destined to continue shrinking, but never disappear into infinite regress until he starves to death. I imagine him spinning in the vortex of an atom, a human gyroscope, arms and legs extended like Adam Cadman, Leonardo's Vitruvian Man. Out of nowhere, Shana says, even the weather's changing. The space rockets are poking holes in the ozone layer. She runs her fingers through her hair. I think of string theory, fractals, Heraclitus never standing in the same river twice. I see the constellations drifting apart, hear the shifting of the tectonic plates and the drift of the polar ice caps. I walk Shana to the dining room table, get the nebulizer ready, and watch her take her breaths. I make a cup of coffee for her, and she whispers, I still miss my cigarettes. The Incredible Shrinking Man has gone subatomic. He's a wave and a particle at the same time. The parlor darkens and the candles start revolving as Shana recedes into the darkness, spinning like a star. That's wonderful. And this next one's also part of the series. It's kind of out of order, but it sort of works. It's called Shana, A Photograph, 1936. She emerges into the haze of red light, a young man's shadow on the wall behind her. Beneath the mock vamping of the pose, her modesty melds with desire. The bottom of the towel reaches her uppermost thigh, the top bunched with her left arm under her breasts. She sits, her right hand cupped on the towel, as she tries on the legato gestures of becoming, as if her hand holds a fragile artifact of possibility, box seats at the Academy of Music for Yehudi Menuhin, the first jewels on the necklace of her womanhood. Her downcast eyes consider the facets of pleasure and desire. She has all the time in the world. Run for your life, I want to tell her. There isn't much time. Go to New York or marry Martin, the violinist. But she recedes backwards into the future. And anyway, here he comes, the man with the big suntanned hands who can flip a coin like George Raft and beat up the brown shirts from Germantown, who makes her laugh when he drives his car with his knees. So give them to me for safekeeping, Shana, the poems you memorized, your own careful silence. The Chopin motifs you wrote out by hand, I'll hold them for you until you come for them later. But of course there is no later. She straightens the seams on her stocking. She catches the trolley and the subway 2 hours to work as a typist at the Navy Yard. She'll wake up, daughter of her first and last morning, hearing only the roar of the water, a weekend honeymoon in Niagara Falls, almost knowing that the stories of the rest of her life no longer hang in the balance of becoming, that the shutter opens and the shutter closes with a barely audible click, just long enough to let in the light. So this next one is about Sor Juana de la Cruz, who was a famous Mexican intellectual and poet. She lived in Mexico City during the Baroque period, which would be the middle of the 1600s. Another one, like Hypatia, she was just really precocious. You know, at 5 years old, she was reading and writing Latin. And in fact, I suppose we could think about her as a kind of the reincarnation of Hypatia in a funny way. They seem so alike. And in those days, the only way you could study at all as a woman was to become a nun and go into the nunnery, and then that was a place where you could study. And she wanted to study, and she didn't want to get married. And she did. She became a nun, but not the kind of nun that most of us would think of. I mean, she wrote poems. She also was interested in mathematics. She was interested in astronomy. And she was under the protection of a viceroy who kind of paid money to the church to let her in to do those kinds of activities. And when the viceroy left, the church kind of turned around and really had their way with her and essentially told her she could no longer read and write. The books were no longer hers. And she was forbidden from doing all the things that she loved to do. And she died taking care of the sick during a big, I guess it was one of the epidemics in Mexico City in the middle of the 1600s. So she was called the 10th Muse by the people who read her books in Spain. And so the title of this poem is The 10th Muse. But it starts with a short poem or a saying from St. John of the Cross, from his sayings of light and love. The conditions of the solitary bird are five. The first, that it fly to the highest point. The second, that it does not suffer for company, not even of its own kind. The third, that it aims its beak to the skies. The fourth, that it does not have a definite color. The fifth, that it sings very softly. These are the qualities of the contemplative soul. It must sing softly for its beloved. Sor Juana de la Cruz, the New World Phoenix, the 10th Muse, the Spanish called her. 150 years before Zorro's old California fandango, not at her lectern staring out framed from the Mexican Baroque in the famous portrait by Miguel Cabrera, but pressing her lips on the sundial of the convent of San Geronimo, writing sonnets by the floating gardens of Tenochtitlan. Shadow of joy, illusion of enchantment, she wrote. My arms, my breasts have lost you forever, but you are a prison of my fantasy. Carnations bloomed in her palms, her face aglow in a wimpled ring around the moon. At 7 in her grandfather's library, Juana cropped her own hair 4 fingers' breadth. She promised herself she'd learn Latin before it grew in because, quote, a head shouldn't be adorned with hair and naked of learning. The ceiling spread for her into the sky, books flushed from the shelves, wheeling in Veronicas that became stars, constellations distilled into rivers of shining milk. Que las estrellas compongan las sílabas, she wrote later. May syllables be composed by the stars. Let me disabuse you of the myths. Before the cloistered nunnery, she moved like a galleon through the whispers and currents of the viceroy's court, where the young men flirted through mirrored conceits and gambits, the emblems of gesture. Serious attachments, lovers, another woman, yes, perhaps, but the muse of mind was her consort, her most beloved. Birds of indefinite color can hide in the light, but what would the daughter of a good family do who wants more than to breathe or glitter? The Marquis de Mancera, the viceroy's wife, ransoms your future, Juana, a nuptial dowry to Mother Church, 3,000 gold pesos of manumission, and you are pregnant with yourself, the daughter of unborn years, nestles in San Geronimo's gardens. For now, no shorn and barefoot sisters under the starlight circling in confession, no thorn scourge. Your cloister is not a place of hair shirts, bread and water. The lay sisters gather like swans in your parlor. They dance their father's golden pesos to the jig and pavon of your harpsichord. You have 4,000 books, telescopes, jeweled seashells, the Avis Rara's colored feathers. You run the convent treasury. You make wise personal investments. The light refracts into 14 rays as your parlor evolves into facets of polyphony that split and shift like Palestrina's crystal desiccants, to become one of your poems. It touches us like the phases of the moon in the voice of the deep song, the canto hondo. You imagine throwing lemons in a pond and turning it to silver, a mirrored stillness that you read and translate and transpose into music in the parlor of your imagination. Cloistered tappings in the catacomb, Juana, currents of whispers over stone, over the vespers, love under will. Your currents, your songs will be muted under glass in the catacombs, sealed like the Sibyl's voice in jars of olive oil and honey for the daughters of unborn years. The viceroy leaves, and without his protection they pin you in the twin lights of Fiat and auto de fe and run you to ground for sins of the imagination. Antonio Miranda, your confessor, betrays you, makes public your private letters, leaves you in the crossfire of pomp and circumstance, in the light you can't hide from, a light you can't hide in any longer. Why should it matter? How could we know the senses of the city of God if Christ ever laughed or smiled, if he washed his disciples' feet for pure love's sake, the love that does not seek cause and effect, or, as you argued, for the very love of humanity? Are the gifts of divine love, the gifts he does not grant us, negative benefactions? What merit to the archbishop's pious exactions? Thalamus or Agape, the evening or the morning star? No, Juana, to have the stars compose sonnets, to bathe them in rivers of shining milk as you do, is not a gift of God, but the devil's temptation. You must abandon the prideful sitting rooms, they tell you, the 4,000 folks, the Gigues and Pavans. They hunt you like the covered bird and wrap your words around your neck. In the end, you press against the walls, Juana, as the stones and adobe close in to squeeze your days and your hours. You write a silence, finally, a voice between the lines where none of the bishop's violet eyes can follow. You compress your world into poems you can hide in, like acorns in the convent garden, loaded with the future, the children of your unborn years. So these next poems also run in a series, and they're part of a small chapbook about the Galleons. And I'm gonna kind of read this, girl, because I don't want to get the facts all wrong. Well, maybe I won't. So the Galleons were ex-students and clerics and ex-monks in the, I guess it was the 1300s, 1200s and 1300s, in Germany, in England, and in France. And they were, in a sense, protesting against the church's practices. And so the church eventually forbid them to give the mass. But they used to go around and give it anyway, and they would kind of sometimes they would give a twisted mass, or they would teach the people prayers in Latin, but they were really the verses to these the Galliard's songs. And a lot of these songs were really bawdy. Some of them were very sexual, some of them were about drinking, some of them were about wandering around, because they used to wander from monastery to monastery. And in some way, they shut down the Sorbonne for about 5 or 6 years, much the way, I suppose, Berkeley was shut down by students during the free speech movement, as they protested both the church's corruption and the fact that students were charged a lot of money to have a license to then go out and teach or to give the mass. So in some ways, you could think of them a little bit like beatniks, because there was no order, there were no Galliards, there was no order of Galliards, but they used to make pretend there was. And a lot of the poems that they wrote, and they wrote several hundred, there's about over 400 songs and poems written by folks who signed themselves as either Bishop Golius or the Galliards or they're anonymous. And those songs were found in the late 1800s in a monastery in Bjorn, Germany, late 1800s. And then Karl Orff in the 1930s wrote an oratorio called Carmina Burana, the songs from Bjorn, and he used 26 of their songs as the libretto for his oratorio, and he gave the oratorio music. And you probably know the Carmina Burana, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to start the reading with a little teeny piece from the Carmina Burana, and then maybe try and read a little bit of poems, and then maybe a little piece of the Carmina Burana in between. We'll see how it goes. It may get a little rough around the edges, but we'll hear the Carmina, we'll hear a little bit of the Carmina Burana. So here's a little piece of the Carmina Burana. That's it. First hit. First poem. In defense of a strange madness. Of course we question things. The violet-eyed Pope, his powdered hands and perfumed rings, his crusader knights in southern France in their red-crossed white singlets, dipping their tongues in the Cathar's blood. De Montfort dragged his armor through the streets of Béziers, his sword arm so tired he could no longer lift it. Smoking love and twisted gold, 20,000 souls undone. How will we recognize the faithful? A Templar knight asked as he rose from his knee and lowered his visor. Kill them all, the abbot replied. God will recognize his own. The abbot sleeps like the knight of Ravenna. His hands are folded on his breast, a thorn under his tongue. Roland blows his hunting horn and a cither strums. Rodrigo de Vivar, strapped in his saddle, dead as a stone, embalmed, they say, his sword, Tisona, cold in his hand, rides his warhorse out of the lay of El Cid and into the camps of the Saracens. Iron hooves, the clatter of greaves and armor. The machinery of heaven rumbles, and the gates of reckoning open to collect what is owed them. The seven golden candlesticks revolve in the sky, and the seven stars are a wheel inside the wheel. Jesus, enthroned, holds a sword in his mouth. The abbot dreams of his acolyte days, his tonsured barefoot brothers, scourged, dappled backs, as they walk in circles under the moon. The shorn sisters, dim moans and confessions. The devil's books, Ovid's Metamorphosis, the hexameters of Homer are pulled from the shelves. Letters and words spiral up from the riffling pages, entwined in pitchy smoke, a leaf drift of the centuries. Thank you. They don't know where the word Dalyids actually comes from. One story is that Pope Innocent called Abelard a Dalyid because Abelard was kind of not living according to monkly fashion. And it refers to like Goliath, because Goliath was primitive and Abelard wasn't behaving himself, so he was a Galliard. Another definition is that it means like Galliard, a gay fellow, kind of in French. And another meaning is it refers to a large mouth, because they used to eat and drink a lot.
Large what?
A large mouth. A wide open mouth, because a lot of food and stuff went. Songs came out. So the only word I think I would define is John Barleycorn, which is an old British nickname for liquor that's made out of either barley, beer, barley, or hard liquor, barley. So this is Galliards, Jonglers, and Low Strollers. And it starts with two lines from the Carmina Burana. Once long since, wisdom was my God. Now love I yield, and I kiss thy rod. There was no order of the Garum of Galliards, no wandering fellowship of secret seals and handshakes. Some of us just read the cross tides and the signs. And yes, we twisted a velvet tail or two, stole the odd pie from a windowsill, popped our noses in the jugs, and wrote anonymous poems. There were heretics amongst us who just wanted a bed, a bowl of peas, porridge, and a book by the fire. But the church held the books and the keys to the pantry. Others prayed for the Virgin's blessing, Stabat Mater, or to be the solitary bird with no significant cover. They slept with hair shirts in a bed of thorns and dreamed of eating grass and rough bark on pilgrimage in the waste-howling wilderness. Some wanted to be put pincushions like San Sebastian. Dye your wool pork purple, and what water will remove the stain? Some of us were sly and went in disguise so that nobody knew what we wanted. Unsnared in the gambit of public gestures, when the sisters moaned with us under the stars, there were no thorn scourges or Sabbath matters, no dim prayers when we gave our supplications. Remember, we were clerics, not full-fledged priests, still of the world, but we fell foul of the dogma. No Galliards, Jonglers, or Low Strollers, the bishop declared, shall give the vespers for the midnight office. But we chanted the service wherever we went, even when stripped of privilege. We took to the streets in Paris and shut the Sorbonne down. Jigged in the stews, threw down love in straw beds, sweetened with posies and nosegays. Then we pushed the jug across the table. We slapped down the bedding bones and fathomed the bowls, and we took love easy down in the blooming heather, slept in the Sally Gardens under our cloaks when night came across the levels. Framed am I of flimsy stuff, Bishop Coleus wrote, fit for levitation. All that Venus bids me do, do I with erection. The Carmen Burana will never tell the half of it. We toast whoever pays the bill. We drink to the wine-flushed, painted sisters, to those whose hearts go in two directions, to those at odds, the rounders and the second sheep, the outriders looking over their shoulders. And we drink to whatever's gaining on them. Here's to the poachers on the breaking wheel for filching a deer and some sorry-looking pheasant. Here's to the harridans, the topers and the poltroons, the red-nosed tipplers and the cut-purse and the pillory. Here's to John Barleycorn till the end of the seasons. Here's to the bride of just prima noctis, first night privilege for the castle lord. By oak and ash and bitter thorn the husband swears, may his lordship rot in stinking armor, burn the sheets and the wedding clothes. Here's to kind winds for the seafarer's sails, who crashes the jug down and looks to the tide. Old tales and hot vapors dance in his head, his eyes upon the starry plow and hand upon the tiller. Here's to the nut-brown ale and barley beer and John Barleycorn's return each year and the lies they tell about us. Here's the lightweight dirge for Jack the scribe, killed last year in the King's Head Tavern when the dice rolled his way across the table. As good a fiddler as ever fiddled on a string He could make the women moan like doves with the tune his wires would sing. And he could rhyme and riddle too. From Brigadred where thou mayst pass every night and all, to purgatory thou wilt come at last, and Christ receive thy soul. Fire and flea and kindle thee, and Christ receive thy soul. Hypatia, the Gnostics, the celibate Cathars, thou Cid and Richard Coeur de Lion, all exquisitely rewritten. The Carmen Burana will not tell the half of it. My words, what passes between us at this moment, will dry up like bits of clay in a mouthful of dust. No armature to hang it all on, no light to suffuse it from within. The finality of a body without organs and bones. The anonymous Carmina Burana. The same mask, different eyes looking out in mockery and hope. The work of many pens. A humor compact of many simples. Written in the pleasure of journey's jargon, the turn of an ankle and the nut-brown beard, preserved by the Benedictine monks for centuries. A cuckoo's egg in Mother Church's nest. If they knew what gathered library dust, they'd have burned them before the vespers. Another one. That was too easy for them. So this is this will be the last one. So when this one finishes, Steve, just jump to the last track. This is Paulius and the Song of the Sibyls. The Pope dreamed the Sibyl is one of the Fates in the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, and there she will sit, haggard and worn under Apollo's curse, but imposing, oppressed by her ugliness and sheer weight, a grand but crumbling mystery, heavy with her own disappearance. No more prophecies and riddles. Her eyes are not perfumed with laurel smoke, the living voice no longer in her ears. At her elbow, two chubby, pink-cheeked angels attend to her as she reads from the Bible. The songs of the Sibyl were held at the fire and kneeled into Latin, French, and Catalan. Stabat mater, stand under her, they say. A bell sounds. A voice begins. The new order of the centuries. The kingdom of Saturn's come around again. Already the Virgin too returns and her reign commences. A new generation ascends from the heavens. What I wouldn't give to hear the Sibyl's song before the words were pressed into Latin, washed and purged of their pagan sins, and run through the stations of the church to dry, hair shorn, fitted with habit and wimple. What I wouldn't give to read the books that the Sibyl showed the Emperor Tarquinius, the six she burned before he paid her price, the three that Cicero read to himself, that perished in the fires. In the mad emperor's eyes, the Sibyl saw Hypatia, a wheel of spiked fire burning in her head. The other Sibyls, smoked out of temples and groves, run to ground in the bedlam of extinction. The disappearance of a mystery, a palimpsest of shallow prayers pressed into their mouths, flat iron shadows in Latin, Provençal, and Spanish, when thick fingers pried out the hexameters by those who must play their contritions hung beneath the portal of the sun. The consolation of holding in my silence the pleasure of diminished and abandoned things. These are hard times, Kuma. Give me what will see me through instead of the hem of the Virgin Mary's skirt. love her as much as they say I should. Just one night in your stone chamber by your leave, when the fumes from the crack in the ground filled your head with vapors, the living voice in your ears, frenzied words, half sung, unadorned and unperfumed. They reached down through the years, issued from the God, your mouth, in search of a waiting ear. Seems like a good note to end with.